Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and tech that's entertaining and accessible. If we can understand it, so can you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. I'm here with my co-host John Wells. Today in the program, we'll speak with Jonathan Rottenberg, author of the book called The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic.
Then the award-winning Skeleton Crew. Now that's a group of seventh graders who are deep into robotics. Their all-female team won first place in the recent First Lego League of Utah's competition. They emerged as victorious out of some 250 teams they competed with. And now they're headed to the national-international competition at Legoland in California. As seventh graders, they talk about things like writing code, saving the world, software development. Quite astonishing, but also the trend for our youth right now, pursuing the ever-expanding world of STEM. Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
All that plus today's cool story after these words. Stay with us.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801. PeakArtAndFrame.com.
One day it's sunny. Next day it's snowing.
Then it's rainy. Now it's clear.
It just doesn't know what to do.
No pressure. Whatever the weather does,
our forecast is for fun.
The hot things to do and the cool places to be.
Get the inside scoop from your outside-the-box hosts, John and Jan, on Fun Friday.
Thanks to our all-weather sponsors,
Zermatt Resort and Spa,
Homestead Resort,
Foothill Oriental Rugs,
Wasatch Pub, Squatters Pub and Brewery. Please consult your meteorologist. Listening may cause laughter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Well, depression has been misunderstood for as long as it has existed. While the stigma of depression has been dispelled in recent times, at least to a certain degree, there's still so much mystery around it and for its treatment. Nearly every depressed person is assured by doctors, well-meaning friends and family, the media, and ubiquitous advertisements that the underlying problem is a chemical imbalance. Well, such a simple defect, according to our next guest, should be fixable. Yet despite all the resources that have been devoted to finding a pharmacological solution, depression remains stubbornly widespread. Our guest, Jonathan Rottenberg, has written a new book called The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. He's now joining us by phone. Jonathan, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, let's start with this. You are a psychologist, but you also have a very personal connection to depression. And I think that's important. It gives you more credibility as being an insider to the world of depression.
Yes, that's true. When I was a young man studying history in Baltimore, I experienced a punishing episode of depression. It lasted over 4 years. It nearly destroyed my life. And it was so profound and confusing that I vowed to try to understand what had happened to me, and I changed fields and became a psychologist.
Huh. And you've been studying depression ever since?
I've been studying depression ever since. That was about 20 years ago.
Wow. So take us through the evolution of depression. It's been around, I don't know, how long has it been around? When did people first start realizing that this was some sort of phenomena, epidemic, illness, disease, whatever we want to define it as?
Depression has existed ever since there were people, because it existed in our mammalian forebears. Depression has become much more common. In the book, I talk about why the number of reasons why depression is a worse condition, is a more serious condition in humans than in other mammals. But we share with other mammals this adaptation called mood, which is ordinarily a very useful one. It helps us approach things that are rewarding, and it helps us stay away from things that are punishing or things in which we're not going to get any payoff at all.
Jonathan, what is the mood science approach to understanding depression?
Sure. The approach is to understand all of the different things that impact mood. So there are things that are going on inside our bodies. There are things that are going on in our environment. There are our cognitions, our social relationships. We know an increasing amount from research about the different forces that are acting upon mood simultaneously, and they're not always the things that we can report on or be aware of. And so there's some value in learning what are the sources of our mood. I mean, I think that's one thing that's very unsatisfying about the current model where depression just means you have low serotonin in your brain. There's no questions to ask. There's nothing really to talk about. You just wait until the pill takes effect. And in a sense, many people are very confused about what is this mood state? Why am I in this mood state? The book is an attempt in many ways of increasing mood literacy.
And to distinguish between a low mood and depression, just putting depression off to the side for a moment, you state in, well, this isn't an exact quote, but I'm just giving you sort of the gist of it, that that low mood, not depression, can be a survival mechanism that we and our ancestors share.
Absolutely. So it's very easy to see how high moods might be useful. So if you're a bear and you're wanting to eat and you're at a river and you see fish in the water, high mood is there to sustain your effort. You're catching salmon, keep doing that. But what about when the bear is at that same spot for hours and hours and there is nothing? Imagine if we had no mechanism to pause our behavior, that bear starves. Also, a dangerous situation. So if it's a blizzard and there's no visibility, this is the time to hunker down, not to venture forth. Low mood, again, is to get us to pause what we're doing. When I say us, I mean ourselves and other species, and it's exceedingly useful. And without this, we would be in dangerous situations, risky situations. We really wouldn't get very far at all.
Well, this isn't fight or flight, but early in my career in technology sales, something happened that I interpreted as devastating to me. And it pulled me down to a dark place. And the reality that I could see, because I did pause and I did look at my situation, I could forge a course of action that could rectify the situation. And looking back on it, it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
You know, there are actually a fair number of people who have experienced dark times that, in the full light of history, feel exactly the same way. But unfortunately, our common way of talking about depression doesn't really give us any perspective. If it's just a defect in your brain, what's there to learn from? If you have a disease, there's nothing to learn from. Whereas I think that you're right that often that new path that people take is in many ways better than the path that they were on, and that depression was a kind of warning. And there's a lot of reason to listen to that warning. And I feel that people often don't and train not to listen to that warning.
I just want to say quickly, and sorry for taking so much time, Lynn, but
<It's okay.
laughs> but I just wanted to add that I'm not trying to say that depression isn't the black dog that Churchill referred to. It can be a very devastating thing. So I'm not saying that a low mood or depression is a good thing.
Right. And, you know, it's funny, as John's asking his questions, I think we all have our own experience of depression. And while depression has been only recently, I don't know, maybe understood a little bit more, our own experience of it, whether it's for ourselves or for our loved ones, it's all so different. And I would like to say that I think some of the stigma has been cleared up by the ability to call it a disease or an illness, a chemical imbalance. But this is where your argument, Jonathan, kind of muddies this up a little bit, but it's kind of bringing it in a full circle, I guess. So let's talk about that a little bit, how just calling it, dismissing it as a chemical imbalance that you can medicate is not working.
Yeah, I think that very little has actually changed with the stigma of depression from when I was depressed and in the hospital 20 years ago. If you contrast someone who's in bed because they had a back injury, maybe they had a car accident, people come over with casseroles, and they're tremendously sympathetic. Same person, same bed, reason, depression. People don't know what to say. Even well-meaning people don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And often the person who's suffering also doesn't know what to say. And so there's a kind of paralysis, and many people still are suffering largely in silence, concealing how serious their depression is from their friends, from their families, certainly from their employers, because there still is tremendous employment discrimination against people who are suffering from the symptoms of depression. And I wish I could report that that stigma was a thing of the past, but I think that we've really made much less progress than I certainly would like to see.
That's interesting. See, again, it shows my own personal experience with depression. I had a couple people very close to me that have taught me about the chemical imbalance. And I think before I was one of those people who dismissed it as, oh, it's episodic and you just need to change your environment, pick yourself up and go get a better job or go get a job. And, you know, maybe there are a lot of people in this world that still believe that. The chemical imbalance component for me helped explain it to me so I could understand and sympathize better. But that's not good enough, right?
Well, some people actually experience the chemical imbalance theory as somewhat threatening, because what it is saying essentially is that you have a defective brain, and the experience of being treated with this this model of depression is that you essentially just have to wait until the right medication has mm-hmm. been identified. And because the medications are very imperfect, the majority of people have some symptoms of depression after they take the first medication, and some people really don't get relief at all. Mm-hmm. This is a tough place to be in, the waiting for the medication to work. And in the meantime, I'm thinking I must be the sickest, most serious case of depression ever if the medication, which is supposed to correct this imbalance, isn't working.
Well, they have a lot of people on their side because placebos are, as you state in the book, are 82% as effective as the actual antidepressants. So there's a lot of people that are waiting for something to happen, and it's just not happening.
Yeah, and you shouldn't take me or my book to mean that I think that people should not take medication. I think that people should avail themselves of a variety, and that's the good news, there are a variety of things that you can do to improve your mood. And medication is one of those things. It's been shown to benefit a lot of people. But people should take a more active approach, even asking the doctor the tough questions. What else can I do? When is this going to help? Why are you prescribing this medication and not that medication? And not take everything on faith from the doctor. That everything is going to be peachy keen in 6 weeks. It often takes a bit longer than that, and often takes making more changes in your life than only taking a pill.
So we're talking about low mood, but we're also talking about depression. And if we just take a moment and go to the darkest end of the spectrum for depression, you state in your book that death by suicide now surpasses automobile deaths. And in the general population, age 35 to 65, suicide has increased 30% in 10 years. And I read on Time Magazine last night on the web that male veterans under the age of 30, that the suicide rate has jumped 44% just in the last 2 years. What's going on?
Well, honestly, I think that's in part a proof that our campaign or efforts to reduce stigma aren't working very well. I mean, veterans are a very sensitive population. They've been through, many of them, very dislocating, confusing experiences. Many of them have been physically wounded by war. They come back. They have a trauma. They have a lot of depression often. The military has really tried very hard to get veterans into treatment and get veterans to stay with treatment. But unfortunately, many veterans still find the label of depression and going for treatment for depression humiliating. And that's something that really interferes with treatment. It makes people leave treatment prematurely. Inside is something that happens often when people are terribly isolated and feel that there's nothing else, there's no other thing that they can do in order to get relief from the pain that they're experiencing.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Jonathan Rottenberg. He's the author of the book, The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. And I just want to return for a moment to your metaphor, I guess it is, of comparing different animal species. And we live in a community where we love our dogs. And I've seen depression or low mood in my own pup, and I think a lot of people see it in their animals. We're so close to our animals. Distinguish between low mood and depression there. I want to be able to understand that, how you distinguish that.
Well, there's a couple ways to distinguish it. One is severity. So ordinarily, animal depression, you can see a lot of the same symptoms in your dog. Dog does not want to eat. Dog does not sleep well. Dog is inactive, that you see in human depression. I think it's very unusual to see in a dog the kind of profound, chronic depressive states that you see in human beings. Really deep depression, I think, is quite unusual. Although, because moods do respond to the physical state of an animal. When your dog is sick, if it has a cancer or if it has some metabolic problem, it can have many of the serious symptoms of depression. Humans have a number of unique factors, and it's not because humans are uniquely defective. It's actually because of some of the things that humans do well that make human depression sometimes a more profound, a more difficult state to escape from than your pups. We have advanced language. We tell stories about ourselves. You know, your dog can feel bad, but only you can feel bad about feeling bad and think that thought over and over again. Think the thought, I'm a terrible mother, over and over again. And people get locked in these cognitive states, in these loops, for weeks and months. And that's one way in which our depression really is a more serious pickle than in other species.
So let's head into your book, Chapter 8. It talks about, you have a couple of hunches about early improvers. So the title of the chapter is An Up and Down Thing, Improvement in Depression. And I'm hoping this is where you give us some answers, some solutions.
Sure. I mean, I think that's one way to understand how to curtail or shorten your depression is by looking at people who have an unusually short course of depression. And that's actually almost half of depressed people will pull out of it relatively quickly. And what we know is that there's a number of things that can happen. A fortuitous event is one. So having a good thing happen to you. Being able to marshal your positive affect is also another thing that we know. Despite the fact that depression is very punishing, there are some people who have still some reserve, some ability when something good happens to enjoy that, even though they're depressed, and that seems to be something associated with early improvement. And then some of the things that you might expect. So if you have a reasonable social network, social support, people who are able to draw on that support are much better able to pull out of a depression rapidly than people who are very isolated. So there's a number of things. And then there's a number of things that people, you might imagine people can do that they do that shortened depression, from getting help, getting treatment, to rethinking what is going on in their lives and making changes in their lives. So all those things are important in improving earlier rather than later.
Okay. What are some of the other things that that give us hope about depression? What are the things that you come up with, and what are you seeing in the marketplace out there? I shouldn't say the marketplace, in the world of healing.
Well, actually, a number of the things that are making the depression epidemic worse are things that we can actually change. And again, I think this is a contrast to the usual defect model of depression. So, for example, in our culture, we have extraordinarily high standards for how we ought to feel. So people look on Facebook, they see people on vacation and all these pictures of smiling families, and they think those people must be happy all the time. I have to be happy all the time, feel euphoria, feel a kind of excitement about life. And it turns out that having that demand, that imperative to feel that level of happiness actually is very punishing. A lot of people feel just okay, or they feel a little down, and they ask the question, what's wrong with me? There must be something seriously the matter with me. And they become sort of unable to tolerate even short periods of negative mood, and that is one thing that makes this loop, makes the cycle. What's wrong with me? My terrible mother. And this is actually something that we can change. We can adjust our goals. We can decide that we're going to tolerate a little bit of negative mood. We're going to actually realize that nobody feels euphoria all the time. We're not designed to feel euphoria all the time. Evolution is just interested in our survival and our reproduction. It's not particularly interested in us experiencing euphoria all the time. In fact, it'd be perfectly happy if we just get it briefly so we keep pursuing all these goals so we can have the experience again. And so there's some insights that once you have that, you may be able to escape some of the traps that so many people are finding themselves in.
I think another cultural problem, Jonathan, is the way men are wired. Depression itself, for men and women, is a very private affair, uncomfortably private, a lacerating pain. It's something that a lot of people, because of the stigma, keep inside them. But men especially are not one to share and tell their stories. And as a result of that, I think there are probably more men that are living in this hell than there are women. Do you believe that's true? I'm just taking a shot.
I think that there are more men than we know about that are experiencing this kind of hell. Depression in adults is a bit more common in women, but I agree with you that men really tend to deny or minimize these sorts of problems. They often will take to alcohol or other substances to kind of medicate these sorts of problems. And I agree that the stigma or shame regarding depression is even more serious for men than it is for women. And I think there's sort of a different perspective on that. My perspective on depression is that it can be a very formidable state, and it takes actually a very tough person to endure it. And contrary to the idea that, you know, having depression is unmanly or something like that, if you can defeat your depression, there's really nothing that you can't do, because you've kind of been through the fire. And I think if more men shared that idea, they would be more able to talk to one another both about depression that they might be having in the moment, but also after the fact, rather than hiding this experience that they had, they'd be able to talk about it.
And looking at trends, you state that the World Health Organization estimates that by 2030, the amount of disability and life loss due to depression worldwide will be greater than any other condition, including cancer, stroke, heart disease, accidents, and war. This is really alarming. I mean, we need how much of a role does stigma play in helping those numbers to climb?
I think that opening up the whole conversation about depression, and so stigma, so helping people to be able to be comfortable with depression and getting help and staying with treatment is clearly important, but also a broader public health perspective on depression. So I though I think that depression stems from adaptations, I clearly think that we need to do everything we can to try to manage our moods better, to try to manage severe depression better. And so that, in my mind, is taking the problem seriously and having a multi-pronged approach, medications being only one of those prongs, and kind of calling people to a sense of arms that this is a really serious problem, not just for the individual, though it surely is, or their families, though it surely is, but for our society as a whole. The amount of lost human capital, the number of people who don't live up to their full potential, people who, the worst case, kill themselves and leave this horrible hole in the world. And I think that I really do think that we can do much better than we're doing now.
Mm. You know, Jonathan, it comes to me in just conversations with friends who have battled depression and the things you bring up in your book. You know, first we think it's episodic and environmental, and then we decide, well, no, what it is it's an illness and we have to take antidepressants. But now the antidepressants, as you say, remain an 800-pound gorilla of mental health, now saying there will be a backlash. It seems to me that people aren't getting – there's no means for really diagnosing depression versus low mood, you know, versus maybe it's an episodic thing or a chronic condition. It just seems to me it's not being diagnosed. I know people who have gone in to talk to a therapist about, you know, just a bad month that they're having, and they get prescribed antidepressants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. There's sometimes a lack of seriousness in how people, when I say people, I mean just lay people, and also people in the medical community. And this isn't to point fingers, but part of it is that it's so easy to whip out the prescription pad when someone has complaints of any kind and say, oh, I think this will help. And I think that it would be more useful to make a differentiation, which is really not hard to do if you do a careful assessment of someone who really is disabled by the symptoms, so they can't think straight, they can't sleep, they can't eat, and in severe cases, they really can't do the most basic tasks of living. They're very impaired, dressing, taking a shower. These become Herculean tasks. Mm. Versus people who are having transitory adjustment issues that, you know, they, it's not that medication will necessarily hurt them, but that doesn't seem really to be the root of the matter. And I think it's very dangerous to blur everything and just call everything depression.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, are there organizations, are there cultures, are there countries that are attacking this as a national directive?
I've been really impressed by the public education campaigns that are underway in England. There's a movement called Time for Change, and if you go online, you can see it. They seem to have gotten a lot of funds, like from the National Lottery. And involved a lot of normal people, a lot of therapists, mental health workers, and a lot of high-profile people in politics. And it's broader than depression only, but it's really about opening up the conversation. In the U.S., there are a lot of very scattered efforts. I mean, I'm involved in an effort. I've started a campaign called Come Out of the Dark, and I'm very proud of it, and I think it's a great way to begin opening up this conversation about depression, but it's not of the same order right now as a movement like Time to Change, which, you know, if you go on Twitter, they probably have several hundred thousand people following it, and I really think that would be very useful to have in the U.S.
And the name of the organization in England again is called
Time to Change.
Time to Change.
The book is The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Our guest is Jonathan Rottenberg. And Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us today. I congratulate you on, well, your own struggle and coming out of it, and then this endeavor to bring awareness. Jonathan's book is a great place to start. It's really readable. It's not too long. It's well-researched. It's all the good things you like about a book. So, Jonathan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show and for devoting some attention to this issue. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that, again, was Jonathan Rottenberg. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us. We'll be back with a team of robotics kids. And, boy, they're pretty interesting. Stay with us.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
This is State Farm Agent Benita Vanderquay, a longtime supporter and volunteer DJ here at KPCW. As a financial planner with 15 years of State Farm experience, I'm able to provide all of your insurance and financial services needs. My State Farm team and I can be reached at 435-657-2220. We serve the entire Summit and Wasatch County areas.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. 6 weeks ago, one of our guests was Ann Bastian, who is the program manager for the First Lego League of Utah. This is an organization that seeks to promote innovation, science, and technology in Utah middle schoolers in a sports-like competition where middle school teams from around the state build solutions to problems utilizing robots that they design and build. 48 teams competed this year, and we are pleased to have in our studio the first place team, which is named the Skeleton Crew from Salt Lake City. Ellie Vandell, Ava Pronovo, Jackie Hall, Josephine Holubkoff, and Shreya Pangali, and their coaches, Mark Hall and Mary Hall, who is a professor of computer science at the University of Utah. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. Nice to have you here this morning. Well, nature's fury was this year's theme, and you all identified a problem and then put together a solution to tackle that problem. What was the problem you identified?
So the problem we identified was the outbreak in Haiti of cholera after the 2010 earthquake. We made two tests to detect cholera in water, and we also learned that a sari, if you pour water through it, captures the cholera in the sari, so your water is filtered.
Okay, and now this is confusing to me, so maybe, Jackie, you can help me with this one. How does that all translate into robotics, per se?
So we have a mat that has missions, and every mission has to do with the theme, which is natural disasters this year. So you're supposed to do certain tasks, like there's a whole bunch of people and supplies and animals that you're all supposed to get to a certain region, because it's better to have them all together. And there's like a house lift, and you're supposed to get the ambulance to a certain place, and a whole bunch of things have to do with natural disasters.
That's interesting. Josephine, so when you attack the project of building a robot, for example, so you have your theme and you have your goals, and then how do you build a robot? Does it come in a kit? Do you design your own robot?
So there's a kit that you get when you register your team, but also we have a lot of other parts. So we based our robot design this year off of the mat. So there's this string that goes across the mat that has this Lego airplane on it. So you have to move a lever to get the airplane to go to a certain region. But the problem is our robot last year was really tall, so it couldn't get under that string. So we had to build it so that it could get under that. And also there is a mission where you have to get over obstacle walls. So we also have to build the robot so that it can get over those instead of rubbing against them.
And Sharia, these are autonomous robots. These are not robots that are controlled by a joystick. They are programmed by you, and they act on their own. Is that correct?
Yeah. So we have a programming language. It's called Lego Mindstorms, and we program what we need the robot to do. It's basically a drag-and-drop program.
Well, I understand, after beating out 47 other teams, that you're going to a national championship in California at Legoland in middle of May. Are you going to be providing the same solutions at this competition, or are you going to be coming up with something new? Is the theme the same? Eva?
So it's actually the exact same competition generally, and we're just kind of carrying out our ideas and what we've done, and we're trying to improve them between now and May. But the competition is pretty much the exact same worldwide. We met some teams from Korea last year, and they were doing the same missions as we were, and it's really an international thing, and it's all the same.
So there will be international teams there as well, or this is just a national competition? Mark?
I've seen a list of some of the competitors, and it is generally from within the U.S. There are about 75 teams that will be going to this contest. I know there were some teams from Canada last year, and there were three from South Korea last year. I haven't seen any from quite that far away this year, so it is more or less a national contest this year.
Mark and Mary, you're both coaches of this team. Is this your first year? I mean, this is the fourth year of First LEGO Utah. How many years have you been affiliated with this?
So we started 4 years ago, and Jackie and Eva have been on the team every year. The others were added later. And so we competed in the very first year of the competition and have continued since then.
So what we've seen, we've spoken to quite a few robotics teams, and we've noticed that there are some all-lady teams, all-girl teams. There's one here in Park City you're probably familiar with, the Ladybots. And yet we see so few girls and women in engineering and STEM. I'm wondering what it is about, Jackie, maybe you can answer this. What was it that got you interested in it? And what do you think about the fact that you are an all-girl team and you won first place? Does it matter that you're a girl or a boy?
About 5 years ago, we went to this like testing out competition for the first LEGO League, me and my parents, just because, like, to see if we wanted to do it. I thought it was pretty cool. There were just four teams, I think. It was just, they were trying to see if it would work in Utah, so it was not very big. But it was really cool. We thought it was really awesome. I think it was all guys who were at that competition, and I kind of thought that we should start a new thing where there are a whole bunch of girls who did that competition. So I invited a whole bunch of people from my school, and it kind of just, like, went off from there.
Okay, so Sharia, for example, how did they appeal to you? What was it about when they tried to enlist you to join the team? What sounded interesting to you?
Well, I noticed that this is going to be an all-girls team, and I thought that would be really cool, since most of the people in engineering and computer science are guys. And I also liked the programming aspect of it, since I've always wanted to become a computer scientist.
On your website, there was a video, and it showed Maddie Reed, who's from the local team here in Park City, and she was saying that prior to getting involved in this program, she had no idea what she was going to do for a career. But as a result of this, she sort of had an aha moment where she now wants to be an engineer. That must make you feel pretty good, Mary, to hear something like that.
Yeah, and I'll just put in my bit about women in computer science, because it is a field that is mostly male, and just undergrad computer science enrollment across the country is 13% female. So it's got a long way to go to be 50-50. And so it's really neat to see these girls at a time in their life when they're thinking about their future, and some of them are getting turned on or turned off to technology careers, to see them having learning so much from this experience and getting excited about the field.
Right. And Josephine, what do you want to be when you grow up?
I'd like to go into veterinary medicine, but what First LEGO League has helped me with is the research project. This year we focused on Haiti, so it's helped me think about what third world countries there are out there that maybe animals aren't represented. Like, maybe there are so many websites that say send water to Haiti or other countries, but there's nothing really about animals there. So I was thinking about going abroad to help animals instead of just like staying in an office and helping cats and dogs.
Yeah, that's the great thing about working on problems. It takes you out of your own head. It takes you out of yourself, where you can think about other things going on in the world. And that's why it's so important to get out there and be involved in things. So, you know, I applaud that. That's great, Josephine.
So, Eva, for someone who is on the outside of robotics and on the outside of programming, what do you think are the skills that a person needs to be able to succeed in, whether it's robotics for fun or competition, programming?
Well, in robotics, I would say the main thing is that you have to be a perfectionist. Because if it doesn't work absolutely perfectly, it doesn't work. And it doesn't matter how close it is. Also, you kind of have to be able to think outside the box, and you should probably be able to work well in a team, because a First LEGO League team of one member would be interesting, shall we say.
So you sound like maybe you've had some experience, and maybe someone else can speak to this, when things have not gone well. So Ellie, can you tell us about a time that you programmed the robot, but things went awry because you didn't do it perfectly?
Well, that happens all the time. We always have to make adjustments. It doesn't really... If you make one little mistake, it destroys your whole program, basically. So we always have to make changes.
Okay. I'm wondering, do you remember, it was a month or so ago, there was this thing called the Hour of Code, and it was across the nation. Did any of you participate in that? Was it already too elementary for what you're doing? Jackie?
Mostly Hour of Code is the simpler version that's made for kind of younger kids than us who haven't really done very much programming. Most of us have been programming for a while, like a couple years now. So it's they did a lot of Scratch and simple drawing things. We actually did some of that in one of our classes for like Hour of Code. And we got very bored because we knew everything that was going on. Everyone was having problems, and we were there to kind of like help out when people didn't know what they were doing.
So I find that fascinating that as seventh graders already, you're acting as tutors for these younger kids, which, you know, 5-10 years ago, it was probably college students that had this knowledge, but now you do at such an early age. And Mark, maybe you can speak to this a bit. Your day job is that when you're not a robotics coach, you are a...
I'm a computer programmer.
So what are you seeing now in terms of younger and younger ages learning about this? Is it promising? Is it heartening? Is it dismaying that we're not teaching at younger ages? What's your take?
I've noticed that a lot of people seem to be attacking this problem where some of the traditional programming languages, you have to type in a whole bunch of things, and it's very exacting, more exacting even than these kids know, because what they described very quickly as a drag and drop. That means they're looking at more or less a picture, little boxes that they hook together, and that's how they're programming. That's a lot easier for someone who's just beginning. You can still get the ideas of, say, you want to do something 100 times. Well, to write that in textual form is actually kind of daunting at first. But what has happened in the last, 5 or 10 years is that programming languages are more about, and it's looking at a picture more or less. You're dragging and dropping icons and hooking them together, and that seems to have actually made it a lot easier for beginning programmers, and that's exactly the kind of programming that is done in these contests.
Yeah, it's important. You wouldn't want them exposed to assembler or any of those languages. I think this is sort of a sports-like competition, so people are really excited and things are moving very quickly, and to have the drag and drop probably works pretty well, but that's certainly the beginning to be able to get people interested so they can look a little bit further. But are you seeing more tools-based software solutions coming out for developing software?
Certainly different kinds of tools are being developed. The actual computer hardware is getting faster and faster. It's on an exponentially rising curve. And yet the process of actually programming hasn't really changed that much in 20, 25 years. So if you're a professional programmer, you're doing almost exactly the same process that you were doing a long time ago. So, and frankly, I haven't changed very much. So
right.
My job has not changed that much, but there are a few things that help you in the process where, as the girls explained, it never works the first time. You have to fix it and fix it and fix it until it really works. And that iterative process where you start with something that almost works or kind of works, but not really, till you get 20 versions later to something that actually works, that's actually at least a slightly better process now, because there are more tools that help you figure out, well, what exactly is going wrong. Especially with computers being so fast, it may do, a million instructions in 1 second. So somewhere in that, your program breaks after a second. You don't know exactly what instruction was wrong.
It's not easy.
That's a kind of a daunting task. Some of the tools actually help you figure that out.
I'm curious. I'll throw this out to all the girls. As you learned about the fury of extreme weather and specifically the damage of the earthquake in Haiti, is there anything that you learned from this that surprised you?
Well, we learned a lot about the statistics of the economy of Haiti. So what surprised me a lot is that so many people earn less than $1 a day during their jobs. So I had no idea that Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere.
So I learned a lot about like the money situation of Haiti, and also with the earthquake, I didn't know that the death toll was so high. I think the death toll was numbered at about 100,000 to 300,000 people. So that surprised me a lot. I didn't know how many people were affected by it.
You probably had a lot of problems that you could have tackled, and you tackled cholera, which is certainly an important problem to go after. What other problems were out there, maybe outside of Haiti, that you would have liked to taken a shot at?
Something that we were thinking about doing was forest fires, because it's a little closer to Salt Lake City, and we know a little bit more about it, even though we're on the Wasatch Fault. But we kind of learned a lot about, like, ash and just how devastating it can be. It can honestly bury a car.
Josephine?
Also, we researched Lake Nyros in Africa, which has this CO2 bubble on it. And it was releasing carbon dioxide in big bursts that could kill people while they were sleeping. So we thought about something to, like, maybe pump the carbon dioxide out, but that didn't really go with the guidelines that FLL gave us, so we decided to do the cholera situation.
So that's naturally occurring CO2, right? It's just coming up from the earth and being released in big bubbles in the lake. That's very interesting. It really sounds like this project, having to do with nature's fury, has not only taught you about everything you're doing with robotics, but it's taught you about, well, it's brought an awareness to you about things going on in the rest of the world. Right, Ellie?
It has.
Okay, so wanted to ask you a little bit about the school you go to. Four of the five of you are in the same program. Jackie, why don't you talk a little bit about your program?
So we go to West High School, even though we're in middle school. We're in this program called the ELP program, which is stands for Extended Learning Program. You basically take a test in sixth grade to see if you have, like, learned enough to basically take higher level classes, but you're still technically in middle school, but you take some classes with the high schoolers. You have the ability to, if you want to, like in seventh grade, a few of us are taking 10th grade math, 9th grade math. Like, you can go up even though you're in seventh grade, and it's a lot more opportunities than you would have at a normal middle school. Like, if you went to any other middle school, if you were excelling in certain subjects, you could only excel by one level only in seventh grade. So it's making it a lot easier to learn more quicker, I guess.
And we are visiting with the Skeleton Crew, one of 48 teams. They were the championship team in a Lego robotic competition. Ellie Vandell, Ava Pronovo, Jackie Hall, Josephine Holubkoff, Sharia Pingali. I'm not very good at pronouncing, but I'm having fun. And also their coaches, Mark and Mary Hall. And if somebody could help me, there's another teammate who was not able to make it today.
Our other teammate is Brianna Deckett, and she also goes to West High.
Great. Well, we want to thank you all very much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. We wish you the very best of luck in May at Legoland in California for the national or international championship. Thanks for joining us.
And this is Cool Science Radio. We'll be right back after these words.
One day it's sunny. Next day it's snowing.
Then it's rainy. Now it's clear.
It just doesn't know what to do.
No pressure. Whatever the weather does.
Our forecast is for fun.
The hot things to do and the cool places to be.
Get the inside scoop from your outside-the-box hosts, John and Jan, on Fun Friday.
Thanks to our all-weather sponsors.
Zermatt Resort and Spa.
Homestead Resort.
Foothill Oriental Rugs.
Wasatch Pub, Squatters Pub and Brewery. Please consult your meteorologist. Listening may cause laughter.
KPCW's Morning Edition with Leslie Thatcher, sponsored by Promontory the Ranch Club, Nexus IT, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, and Deer Valley Resort.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We'd like to thank our guests this morning. Jonathan Rottenberg, author of The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. We also want to thank Mary Hall and the Skeleton Crew from the First Lego League of Utah. And tomorrow on Fun Friday, St. Patrick's Day, with guest chef Mike Budd and guest bartender Mike from the Top Shelf Bar Services. That's tomorrow on Fun Friday.
Hmm, that'll be fun.
Mm.
Also, I want to thank our underwriters, Prudential Utah Real Estate, San Francisco Design, and Peak Art and Frame, and also our producer, Beth Fratkin. Thanks to all you for listening today. And we have just a moment here, John. I found an interesting article that it seems as though we've been hearing a lot about advances in, well, bridging between neuroscience and technology. In other words, chips that are in the brain, that can be placed in the brain, that can record our very thoughts and produce images from our thoughts. I think it's so wild. It's science fiction.
I think it's scary.
It is scary. I don't want my thoughts to come out
I'm thinking about some of my thoughts showing up on paper.
I know. I know some of your thoughts. But this was an interesting, this one is more creating an ability to help deal with how different diseases affect the brain. You know, there have been many limitations on how scientists could study brain function under real world conditions. But now it's a company called Neuroscape at UC San Francisco. It's a neuroscientist, Adam Ghazali. You want to watch out for him. But he's trying to paint a fuller picture of what's happening in the minds and bodies of those with different types of brain disease. And he's taken, interestingly enough, the brain, well, it's brain waves that are recorded through an EEG. So it measures electrical potentials on the scalp. And then it's somehow translated in. It helps to read what's going on in the brain. The person who came for, do you know, are you familiar with Mickey Hart?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Grateful Dead drummer.
Mm-hmm.
So he's used the technology to image Mickey Hart's brain. I thought that was interesting. As he plays a hypnotic electronic beat on a percussion device, and his brain is healthy, but he's trying to just develop more technology that spurs different types of brainwave patterns based on what kind of disease you have in your brain. So
now Mickey's done a lot of acid, hasn't he?
I don't really know, but I can only speculate on that.
Right.
But interesting, well, always interesting.
Well, that is fascinating, and that certainly would qualify for today's cool story.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And every time you hear it, you hear a little blurb on the radio or TV or something, you want to look it up immediately to try to understand it then, because as technology advances so quickly, and what they're doing is beyond, it is science fiction. It's beyond the realm of what we can even picture. And I always want to stop and say, wait a minute, is this real? Is this fiction?
Yeah. And I think we have to be careful because like the brain guy on public broadcasting, there are a number of charlatans out there that are taking brain scans and that are talking about things that they can do or how they can ascertain what's happening in someone's head, and in fact they really can't.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, the science is evolving. It's evolving very quickly, and understanding the brain is now an initiative of President Obama's, and it's interesting. We need to see if we can kind of understand fact from
fiction.
From fiction.
Right. All right. Well, thanks, John. Thanks, everyone, for listening today to Cool Science Radio.